Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. Benjamin Graham once wrote that the essence of investment management is the management of risks and not the management of returns. It seems as though in this day and age, those words couldn't ring truer. I'm Jimmy Moyaha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the information regulator's latest calls for responsible AI deployment by businesses. We speak to the information regulator and get a sense of what it is that they particularly are concerned about in that respect. We also get reactions from the industry around what that could potentially look like. We speak to Worldwide Works' Arthur Goldstick around that and get his thoughts on how to approach that conversation. Then we have a conversation taking a look at the new public procurement laws that have been proposed by National Treasury. We speak to Anne Bernstein of the Center for Development and Enterprise and get a sense of what these new amendments could potentially mean for procurement in South Africa. We have a conversation around South African agriculture with the team at Nedbank Agri, taking a look, or focusing rather, on how it is that the agricultural landscape is adapting and changing and what needs to be done to keep up with that change. We wrap up the show with a property conversation, taking a look at the potential implications of this week's interest rate decision on the property market.
The day's markets, understanding the moves and making smarter investment calls.
And that's always where we kick off the show, with a sense of market movements that have been taking place throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by portfolio manager at Portfolio Metrics, Liam Dawson, to take a look at market movements and see if we can make sense of them. Liam, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. The equity markets having a green day today, despite a much weaker oil price, an oil price that touched $90 a barrel on some platforms. We still have those concerns out there in the market around what could potentially be unfolding in the Middle East, but equity markets, commodity markets, by and large, markets seemingly trying to make the most of this Tuesday.
Absolutely. And good evening, Jimmy, and to your listeners, and thanks for having me. It's been very interesting to watch it today, but almost in line with the quote that you mentioned at the beginning there by Benjamin Graham, it's very much about the risks. And the market is really struggling to try and price those risks properly because they change day to day. They change sometimes hour to hour. But you really did hit the nail on the head that oil price is the big one. And I suppose to a degree in South Africa, it's looking at the Reserve Bank on Thursday as well and what they might be doing about that oil price.
Liam, let's take a look at international markets, equities across the board, whether we're looking at Asian markets, European markets, US markets. We know in the US's case, we are in the middle of earnings season, so we can expect that some of those earnings numbers will drive some positive sentiment, perhaps around some of the sectors that we're looking at there. But generally speaking, markets seemingly being able to shrug off a lot of the negativity that has been in the market of late. Is there anything that we have from an information perspective that we have particular reason to be optimistic about?
Absolutely. I mean, it may have snuck through last week, but the US inflation number, I think, is probably one of the biggest drivers there because, I'm not suggesting that the US Federal Reserve won't hike their rates, but certainly an easier expectation out of the Fed. Based on the inflation number that came out, it came down quite a bit lower than expectations. And we know that the US exports their monetary policy around the world. So every other central bank needs to watch that. How does that feed into global markets? Well, lower rates or easier policy rates basically means that you can see inflated equity prices. So it's risk on, keep going. But I will say that fundamentals have really backed that up. You look at the amount of money flowing into global equities. You look at the support through the AI boom and then just robust profit margins. I think we're seeing some of the highest profit margins in history. You have to say that it's quite a healthy place to be a listed corporate at the moment.
Liam, let's take a look at commodity markets. The gold price holding above that $4,000 fine ounce, it's dipped below. It's managed to maintain its ground, and that $4,000 fine ounce level kind of becoming a critical level for the gold price. We're seeing the platinum pricing stay strong. We're seeing palladium slightly recover, silver slightly recover. I guess the overall mood around this is, even with the unnerving oil price, markets are still finding other areas where potentially returns have come under pressure. Or is it just a fact that markets are adapting to the reality of the Middle East and saying that even with this reality that could potentially be with us for an indefinite period of time, there are other areas we can be looking?
Yes, exactly. The Middle East, back in March, the scenarios that were being put out were very much about how long will the war last. And in fact, we'd seen gold price higher. I think in January, February, it was up at about $5,500 per ounce. So it's quite a bit off that peak. But for South Africa, at least, bringing it back home, those are very healthy numbers to see, the $4,000 per ounce. There's been a lot of resistance there for gold holding at that level. But we mustn't forget that that's quite a elevated level to what we would have seen a number of years ago. That's the hedge against a lot of what's going on in the market, whether you subscribe to the idea of dollar debasement, whether you look at the debt around the world in governments and corporates, or even just say there's so much geopolitical risk here, we don't know what will happen. For South Africa, if we look at the oil price, that's the thing that hurts us as a consumer. But the gold price is what's boosting the government's or treasury's tax collections, both gold and platinum. So the uncertainty globally certainly hurts us perhaps in one pocket, but it benefits us a little on the other as governments are able to provide a little bit of relief, hopefully, to some of the consumers in various policies that they may have.
Liam, before I let you go, can we take a look at the rand against the US dollar? The dollar basket holding strong. There's still a clear interest in trading US dollars, or at least in holding US dollars at the moment. But at the same time, the rand also still below 16.50, not giving back too much against the greenback and strengthening against the other major currencies as well. What do we make of the rand's resilience in this week that has an interest rate decision coming?
I think it can be attributed to a number of things. I'm not sure we have enough time to go through all of it, but high commodity prices, good tax collections by the government, a credible central bank, Operation Vulindlela coming through with their growth and policy reforms. We've seen a number of things slowly speeding up that flywheel. And I think that we're experiencing it, that even with this this risk off in a global context, the rand is holding quite steady. And that's a pretty good measure of where South Africa is at the moment, especially in an environment that's, to an extent, favoring emerging markets. We're benefiting for a change.
It's always nice to be on the receiving end of some positive market movements, and hopefully those market movements will continue. For now, we'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Liam Dawson, Portfolio Manager at Portfolio Metrics, joining us to share his thoughts on markets and some of the driving factors behind them.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
There's a song that goes, money can't buy me love. And that's true. But then they told us, all you need is love. Which anybody with a mortgage will tell you, most certainly is not true. Love won't pay your parking tickets. Or your student loan. It's also needy. It requires effort, availability, constant care. But more importantly, love requires time. And while money can't buy you love, it can certainly free up some of your time. Time to spend on the things you love, with the people you love. And if you're looking, maybe even time to find the one you love. That's why, after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do the things you love. And don't you love that about investing? Alan Gray, long-term investing. Alan Gray is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We've seen an increase in the number of artificial intelligence use cases. One of those use cases in particular has been the rising popularity in voice agents. You get a phone call. On the other end of the phone call is not a human being, but an AI recorded voice that is trying to sell you something. I, for one, am not too pleasantly surprised by this development, and I can imagine a lot of South Africans share that view. So much so that the Information Regulator of South Africa is equally concerned about certain aspects around the use of artificial intelligence in voice agents. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the Senior Manager for AI Analysis at the Information Regulator of South Africa, Langi Themba Mazibu, who joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Langi, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. What presents the greatest concern for the Information Regulator around the use of artificial intelligence in voice agents?
Good evening. Thank you, Jamie, and good evening to your listeners. The biggest challenge we have is looking at these AI agents is where they collect this information from. You know, you'll see from Section 12 of POPIA that they're obligated to collect the personal information directly from data subjects. So if they're using this information, where are they collecting this information from? Because we know that AI agents can be powerful, but the underlying data is what drives them.
Langi, aside from the data collection, I'd imagine in line with Papia, we're also looking at the use of that data, because that then speaks to whether or not I consented to giving of that data. And that's a whole separate conversation that we've had around Papia and what it is that marketing particular and cold call agents are allowed to do. Where does AI then kind of fit into this? Because it doesn't necessarily absolve them from responsibility if a business is using AI simply because there's no agent on the other side.
You know, it doesn't. I think we've seen this move because previously you would have people calling and it was deemed that it was fine and you could market to people using the telephone. But that is electronic communication, and there's a Section 69 of POPIA that governs the use of electronic communications when you are marketing directly to people. I mean, even in Section 11.1A of POPIA, it requires you to get the consent of anyone you want to, whose personal information you want to process. That includes collection, sharing, and selling of this personal information. And a lot of times we just give away this information on our apps and the like.
Langi, can we take a look at how businesses should be responsibly deploying artificial intelligence solutions, particularly where it relates to things like Papia and the role that the Information Regulator plays in the South African context? We've already looked to address the issue of unwarranted spam calls, and the last thing we'd want is to have this turn into more of that with no clear direction on perhaps how we should be approaching this. Businesses that are out there that are looking to deploy AI agents, what should they be doing to safeguard those that they engage with and how it is that they use AI?
Indeed, they should just make sure that they comply with the 8 conditions for lawful processing of personal information. This includes also looking at Regulation 41B, which requires that these companies conduct a personal information impact assessment. This involves looking at all the personal information that you'll be processing and all what impacts will there be to that information, will they be adverse or not, and just following the prescripts of POPIA in terms of Section 69 as well.
Certainly some important concerns being raised by the Information Regulator around the responsible deployment of artificial intelligence where it relates to businesses. We're going to be keeping an eye on this and seeing how it is that this would potentially impact South Africans going forward. For now, I'll leave the conversation on that note. Langi Themba Mazibu, Senior Manager for AI Analysis at the Information Regulator of South Africa, joining us to take a look at how it is that AI should be processed or should be handled by businesses. We're going to be going into the second half of this particular conversation, looking at the business aspects of it and how businesses should be dealing with it from their perspective. And for that, I'm joined on the line by Managing Director of Worldwide Works, Arthur Goldstuck, to see if we can make sense of this. Arthur, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. You just heard my conversation with the information regulator around the responsible use cases for artificial intelligence, particularly in the business context. From a business perspective, I suppose, let's talk how realistic some of these expectations are and what businesses should be doing from their responsibilities perspective.
Hi, Jimmy. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. How are you, Arthur?
Good, thank you. I was very impressed with the information regulator's perspective because it really encapsulates how we need to be looking at AI in terms of communication between companies and their customers.
Arthur, where does the company or the companies that are using AI, where do they start to kind of fall short, or perhaps where do they start to misuse AI that could potentially have organizations like the information regulator concerned?
At the moment, the biggest problem is when the companies believe that AI simply replaces a call center or a contact center and replaces humans communicating with humans. Because when they take that approach, it tends to be trying to save money, simply trying to cut down on staff costs, instead of looking at how do they use AI to enhance the communication between humans and other human beings. So when they go with the first approach, they do fall foul of personal information, but they also fall foul of business strategy in general, because the customer does not trust a business that calls them pretending to be human and they turn out to be AI. They also don't trust them when the human doesn't have an option of defaulting the call to another human being. So it's a strategic issue as much as it's a technology issue.
Arthur, from a business perspective, what are some of the opportunity sets that exist for AI if we are to assess, I suppose, the use cases that are being implemented at the moment? If we're looking at that broadly from being able to improve systems, enhance efficiencies, where does the business proposition sit in favor of the use of AI?
There are three industries that will benefit massively in the coming years if they use it effectively, efficiently, and in a human-oriented way. And that is the banking and insurance industry, or let's say financial services in general, the healthcare sector, massive opportunity to bring healthcare advice, but also responsiveness to ordinary people in a way that's not possible before. So those are the two major sectors. But in general, any company that has a large customer base and uses contact centers to contact their customers, so what they call business process outsourcing, that entire industry has the opportunity to become far more responsive and far more human. Because right now, you get a call from a call center, a human being calling you and reading from a script. That is far worse than an AI that can adapt as it goes along. So you can enhance both the humans and the AIs in that whole industry and make that industry more effective, but also more acceptable, because most people hate getting a call from a telemarketer who's reading from a script. Now imagine that telemarketer can become even more human, or actually become human as opposed to just being someone reading from a script. That's what AI allows them to become. So AI actually enhances the human being, doesn't replace the human being. And when you use AI to replace the human being, that's when you lose the customer trust.
Speaking of customer trust, Arthur, before I let you go, I want to take a look at how important that is in terms of safeguarding consumers and protecting consumers, because we know that artificial intelligence in all its glory and its hype at the moment could potentially be used, or misused rather, for nefarious purposes. And that poses quite a security risk as well, given how quickly this is advancing and how some AIs even store information. If we look at that and we look at kind of the overall data protection implications and that around the consumers and businesses, AI, should it remain parts of these businesses, or should we be taking a more careful approach as to how it is that we implement it in business?
Jimmy, you hit the nail on the head with regard to AI being used for nefarious purposes and therefore people losing trust in AI. But what that does is highlights the need to build trust into the process from the start. So any company using AI must look at how they incorporate trust, how it becomes part of the fabric of what they do, as opposed to what you would call a bolt-on. So it's got to be built in and not bolted on. Because once you bolt it on, you've actually lost the trust of the customer.
Having to think about how it is that we use artificial intelligence in businesses is becoming ever more critical and important, especially as businesses continue to advance and advance their own objectives. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to Managing Director at Worldwide Works, Arthur Goldstuck, for joining us to take a look at the use of artificial intelligence by businesses in everyday engagements, particularly for voice agents that are contacting South African consumers.
Look, being able to say my partner and I have traveled to 52 countries in 5 years is a great conversation starter. But that's not why I'm a client of Standard Bank Private. It's for moments like these. Babe, will you marry me?
Yes!
It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get up to 50% back in UCount rewards points on domestic and international flights. Search UCount Travel Mall to find out more. Standard Bank. It can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Hi, I need finance to transport crops.
You need to get it to the right ports. With a buyer lined up across the ocean and assurance you'll get paid, plus funding for next season.
Well, I was thinking basic asset finance, but financial solutions
that make global trade happen
is what I should be thinking.
At Nedbank, we see more than farming. From agriculture production loans to global trade expertise, we help agribusinesses think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The latest proposals by National Treasury related to public procurement regulation amendments have been out in the public for comment. That window of comment closed a little earlier in this month. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail and trying to unpack the potential implications of these latest draft proposals. I'm joined on the line by Executive Director at the Center for Development and Enterprise, Anne Bernstein, to see if we can make sense of this. Anne, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Give us an overview and perhaps a background around the particular draft regulations that have been put forward here and perhaps how they differ from what we currently have in place around the Public Procurement Act.
Good evening. Public procurement is really important, and there's no authoritative estimate, but at least 500 billion rand is spent by the state and state-owned entities every year. And this is not just a financial issue. This is how government buys the goods that we need as a society. It affects what textbooks we get. Do we get them on time? Do we get them at a decent price? It affects, does the hospital have machines? Does it have the medicines you need? You know, does the municipality get the fuel for the buckies to fix your water pipe? So this is a very important issue, and it has been a singular failure in many respects in the country until now. We don't buy well. We buy at very high costs, and often there are enormous delays which push up the costs and all sorts of things that go wrong. So the Treasury has come with these draft regulations, and I should immediately say there are some things. This is not, we're not wholesale rejecting this. We've looked at it very carefully. There are some things like greater transparency that are good reforms, and we would support those. But we're very concerned about the provisions for preferential procurement. And we think these are complex, and they are going to push up the costs of procurement throughout the state system. So there are really two issues that you should ask yourself. The one is, how simple are these procurement rules? Do you and I understand them? Does the average official understand them in Rustenburg or in, you know, in some part of a great big SOE? So are they simple? Now, simple is very important because when you introduce complexity, there's this decision, there's this uncertainty, there's this delay, or there are these three people you have to get their okay on. At each stage of that complexity, opportunities for delay and for corruption come in. So you have to think about simplicity and you have to think about value for money. This is how they spend our tax money. And we've got to get value for money because we have an expanding population and we don't have a lot of money. So those are the criteria one needs to think about when looking at the new draft regulations.
And this is clearly an important issue that we do need to address. We know, as you've highlighted, some of the problems we've experienced in the past. How far does this draft policy go in addressing this? And where does the policy perhaps miss some of the key things that we've been made aware of in our investigations in the past as to where public procurement has been lacking?
Well, we're very concerned about the preferential procurement provisions of these draft new regulations. We think they increase complexity, they increase opportunities for corruption, they're going to be expensive and difficult to implement. So there are three different ones. These are very complex, so I don't want to go into the detail because people will get lost in the detail. But in our view, the government should substantially reconsider the proposed regulations. They're proposing set-asides for certain kinds of people and firms. They've changed the requirements of the BEE provisions that everybody's been working towards of, for example, majority black-owned companies. They're now saying they have to be 100% black-owned companies if they're going to qualify. There are various, I can bore you all with some of the detail, but essentially we're saying reconsider the set-asides. These are inherently inefficient and shouldn't be used. We should ditch pre-qualification. In other words, if you don't qualify, you don't even have a chance to tender for some item the state wants. We're saying this is a terrible approach to procurement. It will reduce competition and therefore prices will go up. We're saying abandon the compulsory subcontracting model. So if you get a tender over 100 million rand, they can ask you after they've done a feasibility study that there are three or more companies that could tender for subcontracting an enormous proportion of this big tender of 100 million. We're saying this is going to drive up costs dramatically. So there are a whole lot of areas, especially with regard to preferential procurement, we're saying this is the wrong road to go. We're going to make things more complex and we're not going to put South Africa on a better route to spending that 500 billion every year so that we get value for money.
More complex is certainly what we don't want. And before I let you go, I want to take a look at how this potential draft aligns with the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development standards, the OECD standards that we see being applied globally. Does this push us closer towards that alignment, or does this potentially push us further away and simply shift the goalposts?
Well, I don't know the OECD sort of standard. Yeah, we didn't look at that. We looked at the detail of this 102-page set of draft regulations to try and really understand what they were trying to do and whether we thought this would help the country. You know, the bottom line is that the fastest way to empower the largest numbers of black South Africans is to have a state that works and not one mired in corruption or hamstrung by complicated, time-consuming procurement processes that seek first and foremost to funnel resources to favored constituencies. You know, one of the lessons we need to learn from the last 25 years is that if you have a policy, say procurement, and then you load onto it, not just how to procure, but other social policies as well. Who to procure to? Women-owned companies, 100% black-owned companies, small businesses. You know, you can go through a long list, disabled people, veterans. Now, these might be people we do want as a society to assist, but don't do it through procurement in this way. It makes it very difficult to know how we get value for money. And so we're really saying this is the wrong approach in the preferential procurement area. There are some positives, like greater transparency overall, but this is the wrong approach to deal with how we spend so much money, and that affects so many millions of South Africans.
The basis is simple. We would like a state that works, because a working state is one that looks after its people. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Executive Director for the Center of Development and Enterprise, Anne Bernstein, joining us to take a look at the latest draft regulations around public procurement that have been put forward by National Treasury, and trying to make sense of what it is that they aim to achieve.
I'm Nobukhanya Mtambo, the host of MoneyWeb's small business podcast, Mzansi Business, built around the real voices of South African entrepreneurs. This is where the conversation becomes real, where business owners share what it actually takes to build, not just succeed, but survive. We shine the spotlight on local businesses, their challenges, growth, and what it takes to succeed. Each episode becomes a moment of truth, a decision point, a lesson, a turning point in a real business journey.
The podcast delivers deep, honest conversations with entrepreneurs navigating real decisions. This is where trust is built.
Money, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
Africa. If it's about Africa, then it's our business. Catch the Business of Africa podcast with myself, Duduzile Ramela, here on MoneyWeb on the 4th of April and every fortnight after that. We are on the following platforms: MoneyWeb website and app, Iono, Spotify, and YouTube. Please remember to like, subscribe, and share.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This feature is brought to you by Nedbank Commercial Banking. Grow your agribusiness. Think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank.
The world of agriculture is undergoing a fundamental shift in how it is that we are reading the agricultural landscape, and that could mean a whole new set of considerations that we have to be confronted with, or that we have to deal with. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the team at Nedbank Agri. I'm joined on the line by the head of sales at Nedbank Agriculture, Daniel Rousseau, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Daniel, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Now, I saw a piece recently where you mentioned that the agricultural landscape in particular is moving away from, I suppose, what we'd call a cyclical disruption to what would be a permanent change. And I could quite easily argue that with all of the geopolitical things happening around the world, many industries are facing that. But why is it so different in the agricultural landscape?
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy. I think we just need to perhaps step one step back and look like one generation back in 1996, where we still had the agri marketing boards. That was single channel marketing, and you know, production and price risk were largely addressed, you know, through that marketing boards. But that also limited, I believe, productivity and innovation. Now, that was abolished in 1996. So basically one generation faced all these changes and challenges. And I think that's why, you know, it's worthwhile I'm talking around this challenges and what we see, the shifts. So if you look at today specifically, we're part of the world market. We're a net exporter of agricultural produce. So we are impacted by events both internationally, but then also locally, I believe. But yeah, if we think about the more permanent changes and challenges that we currently see, that's more long-term of nature, is obviously the first one is climate change. And it is not something that will go away. I think it's actually increasing the challenge and the risk exponentially. So I think that's the one biggest, more of a challenge and a long-term shift that we do see compared to perhaps, you know, one or two decades ago. And then equally important, given that we're a net exporter, is the changing trade dynamics and logistical challenges that we face. And we must remember that we doubled our production since 1996. So there's a lot more pressure on our infrastructure and especially our ports as well. And we know that that can change very quickly. I mean, we just see what happened in the world the last 2 years. And without that safety net that we had previously through the marketing boards. And then at the same time, we do see, and that's also now, I think, more long-term nature, is our ESG reporting that will come through. It's actually with us currently as a listed company. So ESG and traceability and reporting, that's definitely, I believe, one of the major changes. And then obviously linking to that as well is the changing consumer demand. And that can actually be seen as a barrier to market access as well.
Daniel, I want to look at that consumer demand as well, because it links into conversations around the ESG, around expectations. Consumers, not just locally, but internationally in the export markets as well, have become a lot more stringent around their expectations, their requirements, the things that they look for out of the agricultural sector. We look for things like sustainably farmed produce. We look for things that speak to traceability, as you mentioned earlier, around, especially where it relates to animal farming and all of those areas of agriculture. How much of the consumer element of it is influencing some of these other factors and reshaping the industry as well?
Oh, definitely. I think that is real. Not just locally, but also abroad. As I said, we're a net exporter. And we see customers becoming more demanding and also a lot more, having a lot more expectation in terms of you know, how food is produced. And they become a lot more selective as well. So we do see growth being driven more by value rather than volume, especially in the overseas markets. So consumers are definitely looking for products and experiences, you know, to fit their specific lifestyle, talking about value and budget as well. And there's also a lot more competition in the market with alternative products and different categories of products. So naturally, like technology, social media, also impacting and influencing consumer behavior. But then, yeah, if you look at sustainability, that's actually now also a business imperative. It is not just consumer driven. So it's becoming more clear now that I believe agri is entering like a new phase where sustainability, traceability, and also reporting are shifting more from compliance requirements to basically core drivers of competitiveness, talking about market access. So changing consumer demand, I believe, is central to this shift. We do see buyers placing more emphasis on provenance, transparency, verifiable production practices, as you alluded to as well. So yeah, traceability as a result thereof is becoming a market access requirement rather than voluntary enhancements. So yeah, at farm level, this increasing the need for more reliable data and I believe more auditable supply chain information as well.
Daniel, before I let you go, how then does this influence your positioning as a financial institution? As Nedbank Agri, your responsibility as Nedbank Commercial as well sits in being able to support these businesses in the agricultural landscape as they go through these transitions. How then does that transition inform how, as an institution, you have to transition to accommodate and to adapt to the environment?
Oh, definitely. I believe financial institutions have a very critical and important role to play in this whole transition process. We had an interesting discussion at ACBIS Congress specifically around funding this transition. And, you know, yeah, talking about traditional lending alone will not be able to support the scale of transformation required. So we need to do things differently. So I believe that the future of agricultural finance and what we're also currently busy with is increasingly partnership driven, combining more commercial or typically commercial bank funding with more development finance institutions that typically developmental funding, and linking that to government guarantees and private capital as well. So this whole partnership idea is becoming more important. And in this basically evolving environment, the role of the bank becomes not only financial, but also enabling. And I think that's an important aspect that we're not always talking about. But we've got the ability, you know, to direct capital towards investment in sustainable practices and, you know, typically fund where we believe the market needs to go to. But then also helping producers meet these shifting reporting requirements and supporting investment, especially in climate adaptation technology. So, yeah, we can't underestimate the role of financial institutions in this whole transformation process.
The world of agriculture is evolving, and identifying how it is that that evolution fits into your business, but also into your offering, is what sets the service providers apart in terms of how it is that they look after those respective markets. We'll have to leave this conversation on that note. Head of sales at Nedbank Agriculture, Daniel Rousseau, joining us to take a look at the fundamental changes that are taking place in the world of agriculture.
This feature was brought to you by Nedbank Commercial Banking. Grow your agribusiness. Think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank.
Hi, I need irrigation funding for my farm.
Something that tracks moisture across the farm and rotates your crops?
Well,
Plus sensors that read your soil, reduce waste, and send water exactly where it's needed.
I was thinking basic irrigation, but financing
for a smart farming system
is actually what I need.
At Nedbank, we see more. From regenerative agriculture to smart farming solutions, we help agribusinesses think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
I'm Nobukhanya Mtambo, the host of MoneyWeb's small business podcast, Mzansi Business, built around the real voices of South African entrepreneurs. This is where the conversation becomes real, where business owners share what it actually takes to build, not just succeed, but survive. We shine the spotlight on local businesses, their challenges, growth, and what it takes to succeed. Each episode becomes a moment of truth, a decision point, a lesson, a turning point in a real business journey.
The podcast delivers deep, honest conversations with entrepreneurs navigating real decisions. This is where trust is built.
Money, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
Africa.
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 If it's about Africa, then it's our business. Catch the Business of Africa podcast with myself, Duduzi Leramela, here on MoneyWeb on the 4th of April and every fortnight after that. We are on the following platforms: MoneyWeb website and app, Iono, Spotify, and YouTube. Please remember to like, subscribe, and share.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It is Property Tuesday, and with the impending Monetary Policy Committee meeting outcome set to be delivered this week, we are not sure whether to anticipate an interest rate hike, an interest rate cut, or an interest rate hold. That, however, does have ramifications for property owners. We're going to be taking a look at the potential outcomes and how they could potentially influence the property landscape. I'm joined on the line by the head of property finance at Rawson's Property Group, Leonard Kondowe, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Leonard, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's perhaps get an overview of where the property market finds itself at the moment. We have just come off a 25 basis point hike in the last MPC meeting that was held 2 months ago. What has that done to the property market?
Yeah, first of all, thank you so much, Jimmy, for having me here. Honestly speaking, because I mean, we as South African consumers, we've been through a lot, and a lot, you know, the pause that we had has definitely tried to help easing people's anxieties and trying to understand exactly where we were and what needs to be done in terms of how they can manage their finances. Because as it is now, we are truly, truly going through a lot in terms of, you know, the levels of expenses and the things, how our things have just been going up and up. And yeah, that's something that has really, really affected most. But as we are now, this is where we are. And we're expecting that this decision that's going to happen now, it should be maybe a positive one for all.
Speaking of that decision, Leonard, we know that a lot of the commentary around the decision from the central bank's perspective is the prioritization of inflation targeting. And we know that we've readjusted our inflation targeting from the midpoint of 4.5% that's been around since democracy's dawn right down to 3%. That has certainly had some interesting implications on how it is that we view the inflation conversation. What does that kind of pressure do for a housing market that is already contending with lower economic growth, contending with difficult income levels in the country? What does a readjustment there do for the housing market broadly, especially if we're looking at interest rates?
Yeah, so Jimmy, what is important, if you look at the current inflation that we are currently facing as a country, a lot of these are actually external factors that are causing this. A lot of these are something that we cannot control. And this has got a major impact in terms of how our central bank manages the situation. Remember, their mandate is to make sure there's price stability and financial stability as well, which is important for the economy itself. But remember, their mandate is to make sure that we've got a currency that is actually still valued at competitive level. And also what is important is that they cannot forget that they need to make sure that whatever decision they make, it does help in terms of balancing the sustainable economic growth of South Africa, which we badly need right now. So the new policy that they are taking, and in terms of the new inflation targeting and all that, we're hoping that that should sort of work in favor of us as we move forward. And we're hoping, because a lot of the factors that are affecting our inflation levels right now, Jimmy, are external matters. If you look at it, which our policymakers have got no control right now, that they cannot really change that. So we're hoping that the new policy and the new targeting that should work. And we're hoping that maybe this, as we go forward, a lot of these factors would be positive for the business environment and also for the property sector as well. Remember, once inflation goes out of hand, of course, the Reserve Bank will be forced to tighten the, you know, the interest rate and the monetary policies and all that to make sure that, you know, they stabilize the economy itself. That in itself, the higher the interest rate, it becomes even harder for consumers that are already highly indebted, and it becomes even higher for the consumers. And then that affects your levels of affordability. That means fewer and fewer people will be able to afford, you know, properties. In that case, I promise you, it becomes even a whole lot more or harder for even new first-time buyers, you know, people trying to enter the property market, and even the tenants themselves, it becomes even harder. So there has to be policies that should work in favor of everybody else, and not forgetting, of course, that it should be a well-structured economy whereby things are managed, and the economy should also be able to grow as well to sustain everybody.
Leonard, let's take a look at the decision itself. We know that at this stage, we're all speculating whether we'll get an interest rate hike, an interest rate hold. It seems highly unlikely that we'll get an interest rate decrease, but let's look at the decision itself. In the event of an interest rate hike, we have been at higher rates before as an economy, as a country. We don't want to go back to higher rates if it is at all avoidable, but how much pressure can the housing market withstand if we are to stare down the barrel of the worst case scenario being an interest rate hike here?
Yeah, you're right, Jimmy. I think we sometimes forget that there were times whereby we had an interest rate of up to like 25%, which we definitely do not want to go there. But if you look at it, the higher interest rate, to be honest, Jimmy, it's not good for the economy. It's not good for actually the housing sector, as it were, because the higher the interest rate, you know, the fewer people would be able to afford getting mortgages to buy these properties. And that puts enormous pressure on the industry itself. And remember, a lot of these properties, they are mortgaged. And if people can't afford to repay their mortgages, so you find a whole lot of, you know, foreclosures and all that. And also that limits as well. It does limit the new interest into the property markets, and, you know, it subdues the activities on the market itself. And that becomes a challenge, which we don't want and would like to make to see an economy or an industry and a sector that is thriving, whereby interest rates are well managed and also in a favorable ranges.
Leonard, before I let you go, can we take a look at the best case scenario? How do we encourage the property market through the use of mechanisms like the interest rate? Obviously, the logical choice here is an interest rate decrease, I'd imagine. But at the same time, property markets have been quite resilient, especially the residential property market of late. How do we continue to encourage that resilience and that growth in that space?
Yeah, so it's important, as you rightly said, Jimmy, that, you know, that resilience has to continue. But it can only continue, Jimmy, if the activities keep on happening. Because, I mean, you remember, if the rates are high, obviously even the developers will find it harder to sell new units, and which means you have a lot of deferred developments and all that. And that has got a ripple effect for the people that contribute in that sector as well. So a whole lot of people that depends in that industry, you know, the laborers and the people that provide the services, they'll find it harder, the contractors, even to contribute to the economy. So the property sector has indeed been resilient, and the reason why it has been, if you look at it, our interest rate has been well managed, and we have been doing well compared to where we were. Because, as I said before, we've reached 25% at one point. We should want to go. And right now, and I would say that we need to continue and see how best we can contribute in the best possible way that rates should have to be maintained and maintained in affordable way right now. And things that may not be easy, I know, considering where we are right now economically, but it has to be managed in that sense.
The interest rate landscape is set to potentially change come Thursday, but that has long-term ramifications on the property sector. Hopefully nothing too severe, nothing that the market can't handle at this stage. We'll have to see how that rates decision impacts the property sector as we go forward. For now, Head of Property Finance at the Rawson's Property Group, Leonard Kondowe, joining us to take a look at the potential implications of interest rate adjustments on the property market.
I'm Nobukhanya Mdambo, the host of MoneyWeb's small business podcast, Mzansi Business, built around the real voices of South African entrepreneurs. This is where the conversation becomes real, where business owners share what it actually takes to build, not just succeed, but survive. We shine the spotlight on local businesses, their challenges, growth, and what it takes to succeed. Each episode becomes a moment of truth, a decision point, a lesson, a turning point in a real business journey.
The podcast delivers deep, honest conversations with entrepreneurs navigating real decisions. This is where trust is built.
Money, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
Hi, I need finance to transport crops.
You need to get it to the right ports.
With a buyer lined up across the ocean. And assurance you'll get paid. Plus funding for next season.
Well, I was thinking basic asset finance, but financial solutions
that make global trade happen
is what I should be thinking.
At Nedbank, we see more than farming. From agriculture production loans to global trade expertise, we help agribusinesses think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
That's the update for today, folks. Before we go, I've just seen some interesting news that have hit the official channels around the Public Investment Corporation. We've confirmed from at least three verifiable sources, according to the team at Currency News, that the PIC, the Public Investment Corporation, has seen even more resignations to their board. If you remember, we looked at this when we initially got the two non-executive resignations confirmed. We looked into this particular matter. The chairman of the PIC's board, also the Deputy Minister of Finance, Dr. David Masondo, held a town hall on Friday confirming that things were in order around all of the matters that were concerning the Public Investment Corporation. That town hall was held with PIC employees. As it stands today, it looks as though we've seen another four resignations to the PIC board, effectively leaving the 11-member board down to just five members, of which the chairman of the board is included in that list. We're going to see if we can dig into this and follow up on this as the week continues. For now, it is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Host is standing by with the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. It also means from my side, good night.